Part of my daily routine is my early morning devotional. Look forward to that quiet time when I can get up and read for a while and pray and meditate and think. And in my prayer, there are very special people that I always remember. I remember the older gentlemen and women in this congregation, and I thank God for your wisdom. And I pray that it will continue. And in those prayers, I also remember the young couples that we have here. And I'm so grateful for your energy and for your spirituality, for your obvious dedication to God. It's an encouragement to me. I know that there are a bunch of you that obviously have put the Lord first, and that's encouraging. I thank God for the children. I thank God for the crying babies. I thank God for the young teenagers that we have here that obviously love God and have made that priority in their life. The reason I say that is because today I want to talk to you if you're married. I want to especially talk to the young married couple, but I want to talk to anyone that's married. We're going to talk about this for the next 4 weeks, Lord willing. And what I want to talk to you about is learning to know and understand the needs of your mate. What we want to talk about over the next 4 weeks is how you can build or rebuild your marriage by learning to meet the needs of your mate. I want you to notice that, what I said. Let me read it again so you understand. How to build and rebuild your marriage by learning to meet the needs of your mate. Notice what I didn't say. I didn't say how you can rebuild and rebuild your marriage by reminding your mate of your needs. That's not the point. If that's what you heard, you misunderstood me. But rather how to build and rebuild your marriage by learning to meet the needs of the other. We would all agree that, biblically speaking, actually marriage is a triangle between God and man and woman. In the book of Genesis, chapter 2, it was God that designed the marriage relationship, and God saw that the man was alone. He needed a helper. And therefore, he put Adam to sleep, and from his rib, he made woman, and he brought her to the man, and therefore, they were to become one flesh. He made the companion that was comparable to him, and they were to become one flesh. We would agree, then, that marriage, primarily, is a relationship between a man and a woman. But it's more than that. It is also not only a relationship between a man and a woman, but it is a relationship between a man and a woman by means of a covenant. In Malachi chapter 2 and verse 14, Malachi talks about that covenant. She is your wife by covenant. Where do you think we get the idea of vows in a wedding? You know, actually it comes from a biblical foundation. And unfortunately, in our society, the very idea of vows has been somewhat trivialized. You know, we watch the soap opera, and they make all these promises that we know they're not going to keep. You know, if you follow, you know, Days of Our Life very long. But the reality is that those vows are very serious because they are a commitment that a couple is making to other, not only before an audience, but more importantly, a covenant and a promise that they are making to others before God, to each other before God. And therefore, they make the promise of forsaking all others. And they make the promise of how they're going to live, to have and to hold, and that they're going to cherish, and they're going to love, and they're going to meet each other's needs. And in that, we find something very important. That is that when you marry someone, you have given them the exclusive right to fulfill your needs. Let me say that again. That when you marry someone, you have given to your mate the exclusive right of fulfilling your needs. I think Paul illustrates that very well in the book of 1 Corinthians, the 7th chapter. In 1 Corinthians chapter 7 and verse 4, referring to intimacy, Paul says, "The wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. And likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Do not deprive one another except with consent for a time, that you may give yourselves to fasting and prayer and come together again so that Satan does not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. So when you marry someone, you give them then the exclusive right of fulfilling and meeting your need. Therefore, if she is meeting the needs of the husband, she becomes a constant source of pleasure, and his love for her grows, or ought to grow for her, stronger and stronger. But if she doesn't meet his needs, she becomes a constant source of frustration, and he'll either have to make the best of it and be unhappy, or unfortunately, many times, he goes and tries to find that need somewhere else. Or vice versa. If he meets her needs, he becomes a constant source of pleasure, and her love for him grows stronger and stronger. But if he fails to meet her needs, then he becomes a constant source of frustration, and she'll have to make the most of it, although she may be unhappy in that relationship. There's another passage I didn't include in the chart that illustrates that, and that's in the book of Ephesians, the 5th chapter. In Ephesians chapter 5, the Apostle Paul, Nancy's father used to say, provides the idea of a formula for a happy marriage. He said, beginning in verse 22, "Wives, submit yourselves to your own husbands as to the Lord. For the husband is the head of the wife, is also Christ, the head of the church, and he is the Savior of the body. Therefore, just as the church is subject to Christ, so let the wives be to their own husbands in everything. Husbands, love your wife, just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for her, that he might sanctify and cleanse her with the washing of water by the word, that he might present her to himself a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that she should be holy and without blemish." In that passage, first of all, Paul observes the roles of this relationship. She is in subjection. He is the head. But as the head, his responsibility is to love her as Christ loved the church. That is, to see to her needs. And in the same response, she is to be in subjection to him. She is a helper to him, but in so doing, she is primarily focused upon the needs of her husband. And when you get two like that are meeting their roles and fulfilling the needs of the other, you have a happy marriage. But if you have one or the other who is not trying to fulfill or meet the needs of the other, then unfortunately you have an unhappy marriage, and unfortunately there are many that give in to the affair. Now, we talked a great deal about needs. So what do we mean by that? Let's talk about, first of all, today, the five basic needs of woman. There's a fellow named Willard Harley, who's put out an excellent book. That's actually where I kind of got this idea. But what I like about it is that each of these five basic needs are also very biblical. And the reason why is because God made us that way. And that's what we're going to talk about over the next few weeks. But I want to introduce you to this idea. First of all, if we were to survey the neighborhood today, number one need probably for a woman is affection. By affection, we simply mean that she needs to be touched. She wants to be held. She wants to feel secure. That is one among the top five needs of a woman. Number two is she needs conversation. She likes to talk a lot. And more importantly, what she really needs is a listener. In fact, let me just add to that. What she really needs is not only a listener, she needs an active listener. That means that you're responding. That means you're nodding your head. That means you're maybe agreeing or not agreeing, whatever the case may be. But you are acknowledging what she is saying. She needs conversation. Number three, she needs honesty. She needs someone who is trustworthy, someone who is dependable, and someone who is honest. Number four, she needs financial security. She needs a provider. And in the biblical context, do we not find that primarily this falls at the foot of men? That is, that they were the ones who were to provide in some form or fashion financial security. Number five, she needs family commitment. She needs to know that he is committed to her, and if children come along, that he is also committed to the children. But along the same line, if we were to survey the neighborhood and we were to go talking to men, we would find that among the top five needs of man is number one, intimacy. Reality is that God made us that way, and we're going to talk about that in future weeks. But not only does he need intimacy, but number two, he needs a recreational partner. He needs someone to go play golfing with him, or someone to go hunting with him, or someone to go camping with him. I mean, you think about what men like to do, and unfortunately, you know, God made us that way. I believe that. But unfortunately, you know, we find that, you know, we always talk about men and their toys. You know, they got their car they're working on, or, you know, or their golf clubs, or whatever the case may be. But she needs a recreational partner, or he does. And along that same line, he needs a wife that is attractive. When we talk about that, we'll look at the Song of Solomon. I think the Song of Solomon speaks a great deal about the fact that he needs someone that, you know, in his eyes, is physically attractive. Number four, he needs domestic support. He needs to know that she is providing the foundation of the home with the children and putting in the home some sense of tranquility and peace. And finally, he needs someone to admire him. Someone who has respect for him and who admires what he does. Now, along that same line, consider with me the fact that when we talk about these five basic needs, I want you to notice just sort of in passing how they complement each other. Because God made us that way, man and woman, to complement each other. For example, when it comes to affection, you talk about the environment, held, touched, secure. But along the same line, while affection may be in the environment, intimacy becomes the event. The same is true with regard to conversation. Conversation is the environment. She needs someone that will actively listen to her. But oftentimes, this conversation may take place within the context of an event. Maybe they both like to read. Maybe they like to read books about history. Maybe they both like to golf. Maybe they both like to hunt or camp or whatever it becomes. But this recreational event also provides an environment in which active conversation takes place. And the reality is that what we need to do is try to focus upon the needs of our mate. And when there is that focus and when needs are met, then the marriage becomes happy. The marriage is happy. But oftentimes in the absence of the meeting of those needs, that's when you have the extramarital affair. And oftentimes this fantasy world grows because not only because of the event, but more importantly, because while we have the event, at the same time, we have one or two more of these other unmet needs met in that extramarital relationship. And when the affair happens, the marriage is shattered. In fact, it's interesting that Jesus in the book of Matthew, the 19th chapter, tells us that it is the only reason for which one may divorce and remarry. In Matthew chapter 19 and verse 9. We notice that Jesus says in Matthew chapter 19 and verse 9, he says, "I say to you, whoever divorces his wife except for sexual immorality and marries another commits adultery, and whoever marries her who is divorced commits adultery." While he gives her the right, or she, him the right, to divorce for that reason. You know, oftentimes when we talk about this passage, we say, well, you know, they're the guilty party. They're the one who had the affair. Not always. Not always. They may be guilty of that, all right, and I'm not giving excuses. But oftentimes the affair takes place because someone else was guilty in not meeting the needs of their mate. I want to illustrate that Let's talk about the affair. How does an affair begin? Well, oftentimes an affair begins because you know somebody else. She knows somebody else. She knows another man, or he knows another woman. It may be a best friend. It may be a neighbor. It may be a coworker. And oftentimes an affair starts with friendship. It starts with sharing a problem. It starts with talking about their intimate need. Maybe it's affection. Maybe it's admiration. But it begins by talking about those needs. And when that need is not met, then the talk leads to more and more, and ultimately it leads to the affair. An illustration of that is in the book of Proverbs, the 6th chapter. Proverbs chapter 6 is talking about the harlot. He says, "For the commandment is a lamp, and the light, law is a light, reproof is instruction, or the way of life, to keep you from the evil woman, from the flattering tongue of a seductress. Do not lust after her beauty in your heart, nor let her allure you with her eyelids." Now, oftentimes we talk about the wily ways of the harlot, and wily so. And oftentimes when we talk about the harlot, the first thing that we think about is the event. We don't think about the things that actually led to that event. I want you to notice how deceptive this woman is. First of all, she flatters with her tongue. She tells him, "You know, you're really a man." She shows him admiration. She shows him that, "Boy, you really know how to work. You're really a man." She flatters with her tongue. And then she allures him with her beauty. She puts all the smelly stuff on. She keeps herself attractive. And therefore, she sets the bait. And before long, the trap is set. The bait is set. And before long, you find, unfortunately, then the event. I think the same is true oftentimes with regard to the affair. Life is difficult. People become disillusioned. They find no encouragement or support at home. Attraction is a powerful magnet. And before long, you find yourself in bed with someone who was giving you the support that you weren't getting at home. Consider with me the anatomy, in a kind of silly way, of an affair. First of all, you have Jim and Sally, and they get married. And they're happily married, and things seem to be going quite well. But after a year or so of marriage, she doesn't keep herself anymore. She doesn't watch her complexion. She doesn't watch her weight. She doesn't really care. She doesn't. Or after a year or so of marriage and a courtship, she doesn't really show any admiration or respect for him at all and what he's trying to do. Maybe he's trying to make a living, doing the best he can to make ends meet and support the family. But she doesn't show that. So Jim meets Sally. Moran on the job. And she's very attractive. She's there every day. She's got all the smelly stuff on. She keeps herself very attractive. She's meeting a need. And by the same token, not only that, but at the same time, she really tells Jim what a man he is. I mean, you know what? You really do a great job here. And she begins to show him a tremendous amount of respect and admiration. And before long, then you have lunch together. And then after that, you know, all of a sudden, one evening, he doesn't come home. What happened? It wasn't just the event, but it was a lot of things that led up to that event. Or by the same token, you know, we don't want to make, you know, her the bad guy. So by the same token, you have Jim and Sally get married. And for a while, things begin to go quite well. But after a period of time, you know, maybe he can't hold a job. Maybe he also doesn't offer financial security. Or maybe he's one of those hard-nosed rednecks. You know, I'm just sorry. I'm not the affectionate type, so don't expect it from me. You know, and so he doesn't hold her and offer her security and offer the affection that she needs. And so, maybe in the neighborhood, or maybe somewhere on the job, Sally meets Sam. And Sam is the kind of guy that shows affection. He's the kind of guy that will offer the touch. He's the kind of guy that shows a tremendous amount of respect for her, for who she is. Or, you know, he's obviously very successful in the business world. And so it leads to the lunch, and all of a sudden, you know, she didn't come home. And what happens? Ultimately, you have the affair. I want to tell you over the next 4 weeks how to avoid that by not talking about your needs, but rather how to learn how to meet the needs of your mate. Because ultimately what it leads to is disaster. Where a man and a woman lose their sense of judgment, they become addicted to a relationship that is built on fantasy rather than reality. And the longer it goes, the more difficult it is to break. And don't think that you are exempt. I know you think, well, that never happened to me. The truth is that under the right conditions, every one of us are susceptible. Especially if certain basic needs are not being met. We're normal men and women looking for someone and looking for our needs to be met. And I realize that at times you don't go looking for it. It just sort of shows up. You think, well, it's impossible for it to happen to me, but over a period of time and years, it can happen. And what I want to do is, I want to try to help you to avoid that situation. In order to avoid the affair, learn to meet the needs of your mate. You know, in the book of 1 Corinthians, the 13th chapter, we have an interesting passage that actually Shauna Duggar asked me to read this passage in her way. And I think it's a very appropriate one to conclude with today. It talks about love. Paul says, love suffers long and is kind. Love does not envy. Love does not parade itself, is not puffed up. Does not behave rudely, does not seek its own, is not provoked, thinks no evil, does not rejoice in iniquity, but rejoices in the truth, bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. In that context of love, the first and foremost thought of the husband, how can I meet her needs? How can I help her to be a better person? And the first and foremost thoughts of the wife is, what can I do to make him a better person? How can I fulfill his needs? In that unselfish context, you have the guarantee of a happy marriage. And you know, God loved us. You know, in the book of Ephesians, the 5th chapter, the Apostle Paul says that Christ died for the church. He compares, he says, the husband is the head of the wife, is Christ the head of the church. And that husbands, you are to love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself for her, that he might sanctify and cleanse her with the washing of water by the word. God loved you enough that he gave his own blood upon the cross so that you could have fellowship with him. Maybe there's someone here today who's never obeyed the gospel of Christ. If you wish to do that, to be baptized into Christ so that you can receive the blessings of the blood of Jesus, if that be your need, if we can encourage you in any way, we would invite you to come as we stand and sing the song so well.